Welcome to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, your host, Chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. With me again today are my guests, Richard Bennett and John Livingston, professors of Church History and Doctrine at BYU, friends and colleagues. One of the things that I'd like to talk about today, in the context of missionary work generally, but very specifically, was, as you mentioned last time, that the early missionaries to family and friends, that they would just go out and preach the gospel among the people that they knew. But then there is very, very early in the history of the church, a call for a specific mission that may be a little different than just what they were doing at that time. Why don't you tell us about that earliest mission call, if you will?
Well, Joseph Smith is translating the Bible, as you know, starting in June of 1830, what we now call the Joseph Smith translation, or sometimes the inspired translation of the Bible. And out of that comes the Book of Moses, all those many wonderful chapters, and the call to go to Zion. You remember the story where Enoch was, and the city of Enoch, and the impending second coming of Christ. And it's revealed to the prophet Joseph Smith early on in this whole process of translation through Revelation that Zion will be established on the western borders of America. And it's going to be someplace out in that area near the Missouri River. And later on in the Doctrine and Covenants, sections 57 and 59, the Lord identifies it very clearly that it's going to be in the borders of the Lamanites. And so out of the great work of the translation process of the Bible comes this call for missionary work and to establish the church in Zion, in the borders of the regions of the Lamanites. And so, John, tell us what happens in terms of those who are called to go. Well, I think it's in late 1830, isn't it?
It is. It's just the latter part of 1830. The church is not a year old. And here the Lord in Revelation calls Oliver Cowdery, and along with him, Peter Whitmer Jr., Ziba Peterson, and, of course, Parley Parker Pratt are all called, and they head out to the west. Parley Pratt, of course, has an old friend, Sidney Rigdon, who's in the area of Kirtland, Ohio. They'd become interested in the teachings of Alexander Campbell, and Parley, of course, wants to stop in and revisit some of these folks, and it has a dramatic effect. Within just a few weeks, they baptize around 130 individuals, including Sidney Rigdon, who had been the head of a large area of these Campbellites.
And Newell K. Whitney, and John Murdoch, and many of those great early members of the church, all as a collateral benefit from this mission going further now over to Zion. But this stop off at Kirtland turns out to be revolutionary for the church.
It is really something. If I can read something from John Murdoch here, he says, these missionaries have arrived, and of course, the very fact that they've been teaching, the word spreads quickly. Because Sidney Rigdon is baptized about 2 weeks into the process, it has an effect on a lot of people. Murdoch says, I now said within myself, I have items placed before me that will prove to me whether it be of God or not. Here are four men professing to be servants of the Most High God, authorized to preach the gospel and practice the ordinances thereof and build up the church after the ancient order. They were very aware that it was a restoration. He says, and having a book professing to have come forth by the power of God containing the fullness of the gospel, I said, if it be so, their walk will agree with their profession. Their walk will
That's
agree with their talk.
Line.
It is. The Holy Ghost will attend their ministration of the ordinances, and the Book of Mormon will contain the same plan of salvation as the Bible. These people were prepared, and the Lord is working with the hearts of many. It's not just a few in Western New York. He's beginning to move all over the place.
Let's remember, too, our American history at this time, that the American Indians were being terribly treated under Jacksonian policy. Mm-hmm. The great push-out, if you will, the Trail of Tears of the American Indian into the Western frontier, uprooted from their lands and really terribly treated. And so where are the Indians locating in the period of time that they are early restoration? They're on the west of the Missouri River. I mean, you got the Delaware, the Oneida, the Seneca, all these eastern tribes who are being forcibly moved out to the west. But the message of the Book of Mormon is to the Lamanites. So where are we going to go to where the Lamanites are? We're going to go out there. And in the process, we also learn that's where Zion will be established. Mm-hmm. Just so happens the Lamanites are in that same area. So we're doing a lot of things here, a template for future process of the church. It's going to be the establishment of Zion. It's going to be the millennial expectation of the return of Christ. It's going to be teaching the Lamanite people and others along the way. You see, it's not just a journey. It's a template for the future development of the church. And the Book of Mormon is written to whom? To the Lamanites, and also to the Gentiles. And so you see in that early missionary, to the Lamanites, but also to the Gentiles in Kirtland and everywhere else. And so they make this long march of 1,500 miles up to their knees in snow. This is the wintertime, remember, Brent? This is the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And they're trudging across Missouri snow to get to what is now Independence.
Yeah, the autobiography of Parley P. Pratt, I think, is one of the greatest descriptions of what they suffered and what they went through.
But that establishes a template for mm-hmm. missionary work for the future of this church to teach the gospel to the Lamanite and to the Gentiles, no matter what the circumstance is going to be. We don't have a whole lot of success with the Lamanites at that time, but it shows what we're going to be doing.
And remember, it'd be as if the three of us said, let's walk to Reno.
Oh, my goodness.
Shall we? Wouldn't that be
from
enjoyable?
From Provo, Utah. We're
gonna, I can get my grandkids to go to school 2 blocks away.
In the wintertime.
That's exactly what we're looking at here. Yeah. Those brethren are going to hike.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Past Impressions, a program on the history of the church where we look at people, places, events, issues associated with the history of the restoration of the gospel in these last days. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and with me today are Professors Dick Bennett and John Livingston. Today we're talking about particularly what is called the Lamanite mission and the direct and indirect results of that early missionary effort of the leading missionaries of the church. John, in our last segment, you talked about how the Lord had prepared people for the receiving of missionaries and the message of the restoration. Why don't you share with us one of those specific examples?
You bet. I think most of us remember Newell K. Whitney, Thou Art the Man. Mm-hmm. Joseph will meet him, go into his store. But earlier than that, Elizabeth Whitney wrote this. She says, one night, it was midnight, as my husband and I in our house at Kirtland were praying to the Father to be shown the way. The Spirit rested upon us, and a cloud overshadowed the house. It was as though we were out of doors. The house passed away from our vision. We were not conscious of anything but the presence of the Spirit and the cloud that was over us. We saw the cloud. We felt the Spirit of the Lord. Then we heard a voice out of the cloud saying, prepare to receive the word of the Lord, for it is coming.
Wow.
There is no doubt that it's like the Lord says to his missionaries in section 84-88, I will go before your face, be on your right hand and on your left. Newell K. and Elizabeth don't just happen to interact with these things. They are well prepared ahead of time, and not unlike it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes young men or young women going into the mission field do not realize that the Lord has prepared the way for them, just like he did for these first four missionaries on this mission to the Lamanites.
Yeah, in fact, I love the template concept too, Dick, that you'd mentioned, is that it is also interesting that the Lord always has indirect fruits of the gospel and of missionary work, that those missionaries, I'm sure they were so excited about the idea of preaching the gospel to the Lamanites and the establishment of Zion. That's the driving force. But the other success maybe hadn't been as foreseen in that regard. And so we have Kirtland, and now we're going to move them further west. What else takes place on this mission to the Lamanites?
Well, of course, we're going to establish the church in Missouri. The church is going to be established in Kirtland, of course. And we've just established all those that join. But we're going to Zion. Zion was considered to be in the regions of the Lamanites over there in Missouri, in Independence.
That was the ultimate destination.
That's
in their
the ultimate
mind.
Destination. And so you have a lot of Latter-day Saints moving. All the saints from Colesville, New York, got a buy to go right past Kirtland, mm-hmm. go clear over to Independence. which was the center place, which was the place that we're going to build a temple. And remember, in 1831, Joseph will dedicate the land and the temple, Sidney Rigdon the land and Joseph the temple lot right there in Independence. And so you begin to see missionary work spoken out from two places, from out of Independence and from out of Kirtland. I got an account of one here over in Missouri as they're trying to establish the church in Missouri. And here's William E. McClellan, who becomes one of the original members of the Quorum of the Twelve, as you know, and he's laboring near the Missouri River. This is in 1833, and he encounters this opposition and rejection, and he says, "We came praying and expecting that a field of labor would be opened here. Here was a time that we needed the strength of the Lord, and after supper we retired to a lonesome and high hill, and while the dark shadows of night encircled us around, we bowed before him whose eyes sees and pierces all things, and we poured out our souls to him in mighty prayer, and again asked that we might have an opening," I like that term, "so as to commence our labors, for we had passed through a region of hard, benighted country, and we proposed to hold a meeting, and the people, and they were willing, and after praying with them, we retired to rest, and I really did rest."
That is a great example.
So, I mean, they're having challenges. They really are. And so you have two nuclei with the church, one over here in the west in Zion, and one in Kirtland, and the missionary work is spoken out from all of these. From these two areas. Isn't that right, John?
It is. Back in Kirtland, you know, John Murdoch, whose wife will die having twins, and we remember that Joseph and Emma take those twins, he talks about meeting these missionaries. He says, "Word came to me that four men had arrived from Kirtland, Ohio." So we're backing up a little bit from Missouri here. But he says, "From the state of New York, we're preaching, baptizing, building up the church after the ancient order. It was one Sunday morning as I was going to attend an appointment to preach," he'd been a preacher, "that I was informed on this. I was also told that Elder Rigdon, with many others of the Campbellite Church, were baptized by them. I replied to my informer that it was an insinuation of the devil, but I was immediately checked in my feelings." In other words, maybe I went too far there. Anyway, he says, "and I made no more harsh expressions concerning them. I attended my appointment and got along with my meeting as easy as I could, went home, went to reading my Bible, and frequently heard of the new preachers until Thursday of the same week. I went to see for myself a distance of about 20 miles. I heard the sayings of many people by the way, for some new... some for the new preachers, some against, and I observed the spirit that stimulated those for and those against. I met Squire Waldo, who was a Campbellite, who was bitterly opposed." You can see that the opposition is occurring there. He says, "anyway, he tried to have me take another road and not go to Kirtland, but I told him I was of age and the case was an important one of life and death existing between me and my God. I must ask for myself. No one can act for me. I rode about 3 miles further, met another man of the same order, had the same kind of discourse with him, and passed on. I arrived at Isaac Morley's about dark, was soon introduced to these four men from New York, and presented with the Book of Mormon. I now said within myself, I have items placed before me." And he's now in a position, he feels, to make this judgment. These are good farming people. They've got good horse sense. And they feel like, nope, we can now figure out what the deal is. And they put the Book of Mormon to the test.
Interesting. You know, you talked about the hubs and how it is. You got a hub of missionary work extending from Kirtland area. You have it now in Missouri as they're preaching the gospel in Missouri. And not only were there the indirect effects, I guess you would say, in Kirtland, but we also have missionaries that are going from Kirtland to Missouri and back that are also going to be establishing branches and units of the church in Illinois, even before we get to Illinois in Nauvoo. So missionary work is establishing the church in...
There are 127 branches of the church by 1844.
And I think we tend to think...
We haven't studied enough about all these branches.
We tend to think that we're moving just New York, Kirtland, Independence, but these early missionaries are establishing these units wherever they go to preach the gospel. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, and we're speaking with John Livingston and Dick Bennett from the Faculty of Church History and Doctrine Faculty at Brigham Young University. We're talking about those early missionaries and the effects of the Lamanite mission, the mission that went to the borders of the Lamanites in Missouri, and the converts that came about in
in Kirtland and now preaching on the way towards Jackson County, Missouri. We've talked about missionary work there, but there's subsequently more missionaries that are called. In Doctrine and Covenant Section 52, we learn of more missionaries that are called from Kirtland to go forth to preach in Missouri, and they're preaching back and forth as they go along this way, as you mentioned last time, Dick, with establishing all of the branches that we have there. What are some of the challenges that establishing Zion, or at least attempting to establish Zion, creates for missionary work? And what's going on when you start getting all these companionships of missionaries burning the roads, burning the trails,
burning the rivers,
yeah, and along the rivers between the headquarters of the church in Ohio and what ultimately wants to be the city of Zion?
One of the major challenges that's faced by those early missionaries, now that we are establishing Zion, is the principle of gathering. Now, in 1832, a classic case of this is Orson Hyde and Samuel H. Smith go as companions to the eastern states, back up into upstate New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. It's no longer just a question of joining the church, Brent, or being baptized. It's come out of Babylon. Come to safety. Come to the security, physical and spiritual security of Zion. So it isn't just a message of come and join the church. You've got to leave those farms. You've got to leave your families, if that's the case, to come out of Babylon. Remember, we sing that, come out of Babylon, come to Zion. And so it caused intense negative reaction amongst many, because are you trying to tear up our family? What are you doing here? And you would begin to see this division amongst some of the family members and what have you, because they would have to leave that which they had established. Beautiful farms like Tanner's up there in upstate New York. To come and give all that up wasn't only difficult, Brent, it was, now these are fighting words. What are you doing? And the church was gathering for the security, spiritual and physical security of its members. And this is where you begin to see persecution really generated against those missionaries, because of this message of coming to Zion, because it wasn't enough just to join the church. And so we have this missionary work going on in upstate New York and in the East. You have these 14 sets of missionaries going over to Missouri, and the Lord says you can't miss, just teach as you, along the way, wherever you're going, whether it's Peoria or what have you, but you've got to come. You've got to come out of the world.
In fact, the Lord uses the phrase, if I remember right, that there were people along the banks of the river, the congregations of the wicked that are
perishing,
dying, perishing in unbelief.
Perishing in unbelief.
And so he is calling them that you open your mouth, you go and you find those people and bring them to safety.
I wouldn't necessarily say that the early missionary call was a radical call, but you can see what we're facing here.
Oh, yeah.
It is not just to join, but it's to physically give up everything that you've got and come to Zion. And they would do that. The faith of those early saints and those early missionaries to proclaim a message like that was incredible. And it was challenging all the way to Missouri.
And, of course, in that era in America, there is a lot of movement, no doubt about it. And the younger people, who are kind of Joseph Smith's age, it may not have been as difficult for them. But, boy, like Dick mentioned, the John Tanners, this is a well-established man who has sort of a bed and breakfast. He's got he's got multiple pieces of land. But yet it is the Spirit of the Lord that kind of prevails on him. And at one point, right near Christmas of 1834, he decides he's got to up and go, and he will up and he will move and he'll go to Kirtland, and of course he arrives in time to save the mortgage from being foreclosed on the French farm. There would have been no Kirtland Temple were it not for John Tanner. But some of these brethren that were older and established, they nevertheless feel prevailed upon and they make the move.
Here's a story, Brent, about Samuel Smith back on his Eastern States mission. This is 1832 now. Now notice what he says about, it wasn't just joining the church. He says, I have written to prove that the Gentiles have broken the everlasting covenant and the darkness that has covered the earth since the days of the apostles, and to show the calamity that is coming upon them Well, this is Samuel Smith. And to prove that while in this situation, the Lord was to lift up a standard to the people, which should come forth to throw light into the minds of the people and to deliver them from the darkness that appeared unto them and to show the way of deliverance from the judgments that are coming upon the Gentiles. The message now is, you've got to get out of Babylon. You've got to come to Zion. And you've got to escape the impending calamity that has been caused by this apostasy. One of the great legacies of the early missionary work is that it begins to define the doctrines of this church. You cannot teach what you don't understand. And so the definition of the doctrines becomes clearer and clearer. One of those doctrines is the apostasy and the restoration.
And then the gathering out of apostasy to light and enlightenment. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, and with me is Dick Bennett and John Livingston of the Faculty of the Church History and Doctrine Department at Brigham Young University. We've been talking about early missionary work in 1830, 1831, 1832, and even beyond, as we see the establishment of the missionary pattern of the proclaiming the gospel. We talked about Section 52 and the calling of specific missionary companionships to go out and preach the gospel and the byproducts of that. Why don't we talk for just a minute or two about what we might say is the first official mission of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles in 1835 after they're called as special witnesses. They are called first and foremost as missionaries. Dick, why don't you tell us a little bit about that mission?
Well, much more is known about the mission of the Twelve to Great Britain
exactly.
In 1839-41. Not so well known in the history of the Church is the very first mission of the Quorum of the Twelve, organized in Kirtland in 1835. No, the original 12. The message of the 12 is to be a missionary. And so their first mission is to the eastern states. All 12 of them, they go on this mission. I think it's all 12 that go. Wilford Woodruff and all the rest, they're all moving over there. Heber C. Kimball, Brigham Young, who joins the church in 1832. These are the new lightning rods of the church, if you will. And they go up into Canada. Up into Upper Canada, Ontario, and they go into New Hampshire, and they go into Boston, they go to New York. They're face-to-face with the Gentile community. And this, I'm not going to read all the details of that mission, but it was a kind of a defining moment in the early history of the church that the 12, as a group, were going into the Gentile world to preach the gospel. And some of their stories are remarkable. They don't baptize a whole lot of people. They're faced with some of the problems we've already talked about, but they begin to act as a unit. And missionary work not only defines theology, as we talked about a moment ago, but missionary work begins to define the government of the church and the leadership of the church in a similar way that Zion's Camp did to the organization early on, developing character and personality and leadership. That early mission of the 12 begins to define leadership and government for the church in a way that nothing else could. That's one of the great legacies of missionary work, other than the conversions is of the members, is the organizational structure the church is defined by it.
I think it was probably very personal as well. I'll often say to my missionary preparation students that serving a mission almost gives you a 10-year fast forward, you know, compared to those who don't go. They'll catch up, but it's about a 10-year jump. And those early members of the Quorum of the Twelve, where they're out really kind of spiritually rolling up their sleeves, getting in, trying to talk to and touch people, almost did for them what missions do for young men and women today. It suddenly gives them a very quick and a very deep primer on spirituality, on church government and leadership, and does something and burns something into their circuits that I'm not sure we quite get any other way.
You know, that's a very, very good observation because it's really many years later before the Quorum of the Twelve actually takes an administrative governing role. It is really missionary work, and I think that's a good way of saying it, is the Lord is developing them, is preparing them, and so not only are they bringing converts into the church, but they are becoming
converted themselves. They're needing that foundation. That comes from missionary work.
That's right. In fact, we talk later, I think you will, about the School of the Prophets and the School of the Elders in Kirtland. But the original schools were missionary experiences. Mm-hmm. That was the great school. And they're out there face-to-face with the, quote-quote, enemy or the Gentiles, what have you. And that is what begins to refine those missionaries and define the missionary work and what this church is all about. So you have to put a premium on those very early missionaries and the missionary efforts and how it was organized as a template again upon the government and upon the doctrine of this church.
Mm-hmm. I know when I was serving as mission president in Illinois a few years ago, one of the things that President Boyd K. Packer said to us is he says, your number one job is to teach and take care of those young men and those young women, teach them how to be disciples, how to be good fathers and mothers and good husbands and wives, how that you, when they walk away from this mission, that they're going to be able to build the kingdom by their own personal lives, not just in the techniques or the methodology of missionary work, but the fruits of missionary work. Well, as we come to the end of this program, Dick and John, I appreciate so much. You, probably better than anyone else, know these early missionaries. They've become friends to you. What lessons have we learned and have you specifically learned from early missionaries that will help us as Latter-day Saints today, as missionaries, both full-time and member missionaries? What is the relevance of the 1830s missionaries and the 21st century members of the church?
You know, I would suggest that even though, yes, we have more books, we have more resources, and we have videos and other things in the internet, but really when it comes down to it, missionary work is a two-on-one or a two-on-two or a two-on-five situation. And those early missionaries did the best they could with what they had. We are trying to do the best we can with what we've got. And the Lord is helping us and bringing us along just like he did with those early missionaries. They relied on the Lord. They got on their knees. They pled for help and they pled for assistance, just like missionaries do today. The techniques, the books, the videos, the internet will only take us so far. Sooner or later, it comes down to personal testimony and personal effort. And those who are willing to pay the price to know the truth for themselves and are willing to go out and bear their souls as well as their testimonies become successful missionaries. That really hasn't changed a whole lot. These young men back in the early 1830s had to put the gospel into their own words. Young men and women today and older men and women are doing exactly the same thing. We're trying to testify in a way that carries the Spirit of the Lord into the hearts of the children of men. In some ways, not much has changed, but of course, we have a lot more tools now, and boy, we'd better use them well.
Mm-hmm. I would only add to what John so well said. Having read hundreds of these journals, the recurring common denominator is that of faith. Simple, profound faith. That they can leave their homes, they can leave their farms, they can go out and do what's asked to do. They put their lives on the line, literally, and it changed their lives and it changed the lives of tens of thousands of others. Don't make it complicated. Faith is the first principle of the gospel, and it's abundantly proven in these wonderful, wonderful journals.
Thank you so much to both of you. As I listen to you bear testimony and talk about these early missionaries, it dawned on me that every single member of the church has been touched by missionaries. Every single one of them, whether they be 1830s missionaries or 2011 missionaries, all of us are blessed by missionaries. Thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. Join us again for a future episode of Past Impressions as we discuss the people, places, events, issues associated with the history of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.